this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today has carved a career out of capturing the drama of sport in the written word. He's covered global sports for the New York Times for over 25 years, travelling around the world to report on the biggest sporting events. He's written about Roger Federer since the beginning of his career. His new book, The Master, uses his unprecedented access to tell the story of the greatest player in men's tennis. Christopher Clary, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Hi, Georgina, how are you?
Very good. And I love this book, The Master, The Brilliant Career of Roger Federer. But before we get into Federer himself, I'd love for us to know through whose prism we're viewing him. Tell us a little bit about your life and how you got into sports writing, Christopher.
Well, you know, I'm in my mid-50s now, and I grew up in the States, moving around a lot because my father was in the U.S. Navy. So we moved from coast to coast. And I always felt that sport was for me a way of integrating and assimilating to my new environments. I had to move so much as a child. So for me, sports like, you know, soccer and tennis that I played and were sports that allowed me to make new friends. And I really had a strong attachment to sport from an early age. And I spent a lot of my afternoons at the public library in the pre-internet era going through stacks of Sports Illustrated magazines. So I was really somebody who was, from a very early age, focused on sport, and I read a lot, and a lot of my reading was about sport from an early age, and it was kind of a golden age of sports writing in the U.S. I later discovered it was true of the U.K. as well. So I really always wanted to be a writer, and I always wanted to write about sports. It was just a matter of making it work, and got the right breaks at the right time to be able to do that.
Do you think that golden era of sports writing still exists?
Things have changed. It's trickier now because I think a lot of people who were might have gravitated to sports writing or daily journalism now have other options as writers. You're seeing people go into more into television writing and script writing and screenwriting and things like that. And I think it's become a harder business because access to the athletes, which when I started out and when I was beginning in the career was kind of a given, has become more and more complicated in the social media age with athletes being able to reach their publics directly. And then obviously the struggles of the print media all over the world to find a business model that works has made it a more precarious profession. But I've been one of the very lucky ones to be able to write for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times for so many years.
And how did you get such unprecedented access to Federer? I mean, would you call him a friend?
You know, I would never call somebody I cover a friend. I don't think that's the right word, but it's definitely a great professional relationship. There's a lot of, I think, mutual respect there. And honestly, you know, let's be clear about it. I mean, I'm sure I have a nice smile and a winning manner. At least I hope I do. But that's not why I got all the access to Roger. I mean, a lot of it is because it's the New York Times, and he was interested in talking to a leading newspaper and having somebody he was regularly in contact with there. And also in his business dealings and his career planning, I think he had a special place in his heart for North America and the U.S. market. He was very interested in reaching that. And as a Swiss athlete, you know, from a small European country, which didn't have a lot of tradition in tennis, the U.S. was the major market I think he was interested in, along with the U.K. as well. I was one of his windows into that, and it was a mutual thing where we were very eager to talk to him, and I think he was happy to talk to us.
You talk about him being Swiss, but of course, South Africa has a huge influence on his life. His mother, Lynette, was originally an Afrikaans speaker from South Africa. His parents actually met out there. Tell us a little bit more about them.
Yeah, I mean, his parents, it's one of those situations where there's so much chance involved in life, isn't there, Georgina? You think about it. And really, his father was grew up in Switzerland, was very Swiss. He was an engineer with a chemical company. And he had a lot of options in his young life where he could go and work overseas, but he had wanderlust. I think he still does from knowing him now at this age in his life. And he decided to go to South Africa. He could have gone to Australia or maybe North America or South America, but he chose to go there. And at his factory, he met a young secretary named Lynette, and they really connected right away, and both their lives changed, and eventually they moved back to Switzerland to be married, and Lynette also continued to work with that same chemical company, and they worked out of Switzerland, and their two children were born, Roger's older sister and Roger, and really a history of sport was changed because of that situation. And Roger has remained very connected to the country, especially in his younger years. They went there a lot on holiday. And one of the most moving parts for me of reporting the book was going to South Africa for his exhibition with Nadal in the main stadium in Cape Town, which is where the book really comes to a conclusion. And it was his chance to kind of go back and complete the circle, if you will. And he did that by playing in front of the biggest crowd ever in tennis history, over 50,000 people. And you could really sense there was a connection between the South African public and Roger, and Roger and that public. And he has dual citizenship. He doesn't talk about that much, but he does. And I know he really wants to make an impact on that country more and more as the years go by.
When you look at sports people's beginnings, there is quite a debate about whether it's better to be a generalist or whether by concentrating and having an early specialization, you become a better player. What route did he take?
Yeah, there was a good book written a couple of years ago called Range by David Epstein, and talks about that very issue. And the conclusion is that in a lot of situations and in a lot of domains and human endeavor, it's better to have had a wide variety of things that you did and different ways to train your brain and approach it before you specify on what you're going to really specialize in. Roger was one of those range type people. I mean, he was somebody who played a lot of sports as a kid. It was very athletic and very energetic, maybe even hyperactive, you could say, in his early life. And he was somebody who was always running around playing sport, was a very good soccer player, as was Rafael Nadal, and played very seriously in his youth, played squash, a lot of table tennis, basketball, skied with his family in the winters. So he was somebody who did a lot of different things. And I think one of the theories is that that kind of range helps you in terms of your ability to stay healthy. Too much specialization too young can lead to overuse injuries, and it can also lead to mental burnout. And Roger, you know, told me in one of our more recent interviews, I've really never burned out. I've never had a moment in my career where I felt like I've had enough. Why that's happened is fascinating, because a lot of it has been, I think, maybe that early life where he didn't overdo it, but also in his planning as a mature player and a mature athlete. He's been very careful about how much he does and how he manages his own, I think, his own emotions, his own stress levels, and his own planning to be able to maximize his performances.
Now, he grew up in Basel, the city that staged probably the most significant Swiss tour. But he left, and that was really a good thing. Although at that time, it was, as you quote in the book, you say emotionally, Roger was on a razor's edge at that point in his life.
I think he was. I mean, that was a big decision. Many, many athletes and tennis players as well end up going to academies, going away from their families sometimes at a young age. Often they'll go with a member of their family, like Maria Sharapova when she went to Florida with her father from Russia. Obviously, she was very young, 7, 8 years old, and she went with her father, of course. But many times in their teens, athletes will go with a member of their family or somebody else. Roger went on his own. It was a train ride from Basel down to Ecu Blanc near Lausanne, where the Swiss training center was at that time. And it was in French-speaking Switzerland, a language he didn't speak at all, really. He'd studied it a little bit in school. But he basically had to almost go to a foreign country, if you will, at the age of 14. And it was a traumatic period for him. And he said recently in other interviews with me, too, that it was really, in his mind, probably the most pivotal time in his life in a lot of ways, because he really had to go out of his comfort zone, had to mature, and realizing that you couldn't get by in school or in society unless you learned another language, and learned it in a hurry was very formative for him. And he met some great people that are still his friends, like Severin Luthi, who's been his coach for many years now, was somebody he met in Ecu Blanc, and Pierre Paganini, his fitness trainer, who's been so influential in Roger's career, and also Stan Wawrinka's career, another Swiss player. He also met him in Ecu Blanc. So a lot of his connections go way back there.
Mm. I mean, at that time and for a while afterwards, he did have a bit of a reputation as a brat with self-control issues.
Yeah, Roger was a poor loser as a kid. His childhood coaches will tell you that. Him sitting underneath a chair after losing a match and crying, and all the other kids have taken their box lunches out to go have a picnic, and Roger is still under the chair crying, and had big trouble controlling his emotions and his expectations. That's not unusual. There are many players in tennis, which is a sport that can drive you a bit mad, Georgina. Somebody who really had a lot of trouble with that, however, though. And they played a junior match in Switzerland in Zurich against the future great Australian player Leighton Hewitt, who also was a hothead as a young man. And Darren Cahill, the coach who was there at that match when they were both, I think, 15, 16 years old, I want to say, maybe even 14, said that they were swearing, throwing their rackets, yelling, shouting. It was a real scene. And it's hard to imagine that now, looking at the way Roger has developed as a as an on-court persona and as a player, and how much of a mask he wears on the court. But that is very much an acquired trait for him.
Mm. So I wonder then how he went from successful junior player to a phenomenal one.
That's a long process. And the book really is really all about that. It's about all 400 plus pages of it. It really talks about the evolution of Roger, his process, what he went through. But I think the main things are he did learn to control his temperament. I think that was very important. And he did that with the help of many people, and it was a long process to do it, but he dealt with a sports psychologist in Switzerland, a young guy named Christian Marcoli, who was a former FC Basel soccer striker. Now, he could really relate to Roger, and I think that helped him at the beginning. A lot of talks with his early coach, Peter Lundgren, his fitness trainer, Pierre Paganini, and ultimately he was able to change that behavior when I think he saw himself on screens acting up, throwing his racket, and realized that was not the image he wanted to project, you know, to the sport or to the wider public. And he basically ultimately made the decision himself that he was going to focus on just the tennis and let the other things kind of go away. And he did a very good job of that. And he made good choices also in his people in his team. I mean, Pierre Paganini, I mentioned him already. He was his fitness trainer, was somebody who has been very creative, very innovative in his approach, and has been with Roger for, you know, 20 plus years, longer than anybody else in his team. And they really plotted carefully. Roger would have a long career, even when he was pretty early on in his career, when he first started to have great success. They always had a long view, and that meant managing his schedule, not overplaying, finding times when he could really relax away from the circuit and completely switch everything off. And I think Roger's been very methodical about his spontaneity. I mean, I can almost call it planned spontaneity, as oxymoronic as that sounds. And I think, obviously, he had tremendous talent, but it was by no means predestined that he was going to be a great player. He had to make a lot of right choices and make a lot of good decisions about the people he worked with. And I think he also had to find a way, with his energy and his love of innovation and creativity, he had to find a way to keep himself fresh. And he was very smart about that.
Now, one of the most influential people in his life, of course, has been his wife, who's really sacrificed her own career in a way to make sure that she was able to support him.
Well, I don't know about her career, because it's interesting. She also, Mirka Vavrinec, was her parents are from Slovakia, immigrated to Switzerland. She was raised in Switzerland and very promising junior player, grew up around the time of Martina Hingis and Patti Schnieder, who also were, you know, very good young Swiss players. And Martina Hingis was a future number one as well. And Mirka had great talent, you know, very, very hard worker, powerful player from the baseline. And she, I think, would have been a top 30, probably top, maybe even top 20 player if she'd stayed healthy. But she reached the top 100. And she and Roger even played the Hopman Cup together, that mixed team event in Perth back in 2002. They met actually in Bienne, which is a training center in Switzerland, but they actually got to know each other well at the Olympics in Sydney in 2000. But Mirka's career ended very, very quickly because of a foot injury. And so she, I think, in a lot of ways, channeled some of her ambition into Roger's career and helped him realize what he needed to do to be great, and also supported all those decisions that had to be made about extra practice sessions and time away from home and all the travel. And they have four children, you know, two sets of twins, and they have basically managed to keep Roger in a home environment on the road for over 10 years because of the way Mirka organizes their schedule. They get a lot of help, but Mirka has been pivotal to his career. I think three most important people in his life are Mirka, Pierre Paganini, and Peter Carter, his Australian coach, who died in 2002.
And that death of Peter Carter really, really affected him. I mean, he still talks about him now.
That was a pivotal moment in his life. It really was. It was a moment when Roger, I think, in many ways, grew up quickly because of that death. Peter Carter died in a vehicular accident in South Africa on safari on his honeymoon. And he had gone there after much urging from the Federers, both, you know, Roger's parents and Roger himself. And of course, it was not the Federer's fault that accident happened. The roads are dangerous down there. It was a kind of a freakish thing. But Peter was very young, and he and Roger were very close. Roger was not working with him as his coach directly at that moment, but it was Peter Carter who really put Roger's game in place. They have a lot of similar style points in their games. You know how Roger, when he watches the ball after he hits it, he kind of leaves his eye on the contact point a bit longer, almost like a golfer when he hits a shot, keeps his eye on the tee. Well, Peter Carter did that as well, as I learned from reporting the book. So a lot of things that Roger is come from Peter, and people who knew Peter Carter well you know, sometimes have a hard time watching Roger and talking to him because they keep thinking of Peter Carter because there's so many things that are similar. But his death, I think, made Roger grow up and realize that Peter Carter believed in him, believed he could be a great champion. Even though he'd shown a lot of potential at that point, he wasn't really putting it all together yet. And I think his mission was to, you know, do justice to Peter Carter's legacy. And I think we can say mission accomplished.
And how would you characterize his relationship with other players? I'm thinking of Nadal in particular, but also Agassi, Vlasic, Navratilova.
Well, you know, I think Roger's quite a popular figure in the locker room because he's an extrovert. At least when he's on the tour, he's very outgoing and always saying hi to people and good luck to the Swiss players. If somebody new comes along and is in the locker room, kind of looking around, feeling like they don't belong, Roger often will be somebody who'll go up to them and, you know, despite who he is and what he's achieved, will kind of welcome them to the environment. There's some great stories about him. James Blake, you know, the former top tennis player from the U.S., played Nadal and Federer, I think, back to back in Indian Wells back in the mid 2000s. And he was in the locker room before the match with Nadal, and Nadal was already in battle mode with his headphones in and his bandana on and doing kangaroo jumps in the locker room, just looking ready to snort like a bull entering the ring. And Roger, I think a day or two later in the locker room, and they were legs crossed, kind of relaxing, talking about real estate investments he'd made in Switzerland with Mirka, and just couldn't been more relaxed before the match, and then walked out and played his heart out, changed the chip. But this is a very relaxed person in that environment, somebody very comfortable with himself. And I think for that reason, he has a lot of strong connections on tour with people. His big rivals, Nadal and Djokovic, of course, it's got to be a bit different. Those are guys who threaten him and have changed his place in the game a bit because of their success. And I think he and Nadal had a big language barrier at the beginning of their time together. Rafa's almost 5 years younger. And so I think they had to bridge that. But I really sense from talking to both of them in recent years and interviewing Rafa for the book, I mean, there is a real friendship there. Is it a close friendship, the kind you have with somebody from childhood? No, but I think it's a genuine friendship and connection and appreciation. I think Novak is more of a business colleague for Roger. There's been some tension there through the years. They're very different people. And I think the connection hasn't been as natural. And I think that's maybe you can feel that a little bit on the court and the rivalry too. When Novak and Roger play, I always feel there's a little bit of an edge there. I wouldn't call it a big, big edge, but there's a little bit of an edge.
Mm. Looking at standout matches for you, I mean, I'm tempted to zone in on the 2007 game in Parma, which has been called the greatest match of all time.
Between Nadal and Federer?
Yeah.
Well, I think their greatest matches, I think clearly, you know, the two back-to-back Wimbledon finals in 2007 and 2008 were tremendous. Roger won the first, and then the 2008 matches, I think rightly considered one of the top two or three greatest matches of all time ever played. It was played in five sets, ended Roger's run at Wimbledon. Nadal won it in the twilight. So much quality tennis, twists and turns in the match. And then they played another great one at the 2017 Australian Open when Roger was coming back from a six-month break for injury and Nadal was also coming back from a shorter break, and they played in the final there. And Roger, who's lost more often than he's won against Nadal, played one of his very finest matches, came back in the fifth set and won that. And I think you might call that his happiest moment on a tennis court when he won that final. Those are their main matches that they played. And they played a really weird match in Palma de Mallorca back in the early 2000s when Rafa was a dominant player on clay and Roger was a dominant player on grass. And they actually played on a court that was half made of grass and half made of red clay in Palma, and has to be the strangest tennis match ever played, if not at least on the short list. And, you know, they would change their shoes on the changeovers to be able to adjust to the grass or the clay. And it just showed you how much interest there was in the rivalry. And I write about that in the book quite a bit, actually.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you got a sense, with all the time you spent with him and with all the people that you've spoken to, what is at his heart and what it is that drives him? Is it just about winning?
You know, I don't think it is just about winning, interestingly enough. I think a lot of great athletes have that just burning, incredible desire. I don't know if you watched any of the Michael Jordan documentary, Last Dance, that came out during the pandemic, but that was, you sort of sense Jordan's just incredible competitiveness. Everything he does is a competition. He needs to make it that way. And a lot of tennis players are that way as well. And, you know, make no mistake, Roger Federer is a very competitive person. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been as good and driven as for as long as he has. But I think he gets a lot of pleasure out of just the sensation of playing the game. I think it's the feel of the ball and his strings, the actual creativity involved in conjuring a shot that maybe hasn't been conjured before. Just the process of playing, I think, gives him a lot of pleasure. And I know for a fact that really what's kept him going along with the competition really has been the connection with the crowds around the world. And having seen him in a lot of different settings, from South Africa and Cape Town, where I talked about, from exhibition tours in South America, where I followed him part of the way, to the crowds in traditional tennis venues at Wimbledon and the US Open and Australia, Monte Carlo, different places. I mean, he really is a crowd favorite everywhere he plays, and he has been for a long time because of his style of play, because of his personality, and I think because of his vulnerability as well. People have seen him go through a lot of tough emotions and tough defeats, and they've seen him have to handle that and come back stronger or show some resilience. I think that's connected them to him, and he takes great strength from that. And I think that's something he has missed a lot in this last couple of years in his life between the pandemic and his injuries, is that connection. And I think that's partly what he's chasing when he keeps trying to come back.
And tell us about injury, because, I mean, there are and there will always be rumors of retirement.
Well, Roger has been hearing retirement questions, Georgina, basically from, I think, 2009, when he won the French Open finally, which was the last Grand Slam title he was missing. And he was at that time in his late 20s. And as strange as it might seem now, people started asking about retirement because there were players that Stefan Edberg and Boris Becker and Pete Sampras retired not long after that in their timeline. So it seemed like a possibility that Roger would as well. And he really has been hearing retirement questions for over a decade. And he has continued to push through and follow his own calendar and his own desires. And I think that's great. Right now, he's in a tricky spot. I mean, this is his fourth knee surgery after spending so many years really, really injury-free. He has always had back problems to deal with, but he hasn't had any major traumatic injuries until his mid-30s, which is a great run. But lately, it's gotten tougher, and now he's come back after a long break and now needs to take another break for a fourth surgery. He's 40 years old now. Young players are rising. People like Alexander Zverev and Daniel Medvedev, Stefanos Tsitsipas, Novak Djokovic is still very much, you know, the number one in the game. So I think for Roger to get through this next healing process at the stage in life that he's at and come back and really truly compete for Grand Slam titles again, I think is too much to ask. So I wouldn't be surprised if we've seen the last of him on a tennis court as a professional, but he may have other things in mind and he may need that closure.
And in terms of other things, you write in the book, as we discussed earlier, how important South Africa is to him, but he's very much involved in various projects there.
Well, I think he's had this foundation, the Roger Federer Foundation, from the early 2000s. He started it quite early in his career. And I think it was because of the strong connection he felt to South Africa and his mother's, the fact that she was from there, and his mother, Lynette, was really helping run the Federation or the Foundation in its early years. And it's been around a while, and they've had, I think, a fair impact on childhood education in South Africa and Southern Africa and also in Switzerland, you know, Roger's two countries. So I know he really intends to expand that and to work a great deal with that foundation and expand its reach, maybe its scope. And I know he's been talking a lot to Bill Gates, playing exhibitions with Bill Gates. And it's Bill Gates is a tennis fan and a fine recreational tennis player, but it's also because it gives Roger a chance to find a mentor in this domain. So I know it's an area he's interested in. He's also, I think, very interested in the business world. He spent time early in his career without an agent, which is pretty much unheard of for a top level young player. And he tried to learn a lot about the business himself, asked a lot of questions, made some mistakes, probably missed out on contracts and money. Not probably, he did miss out on contracts and money he could have had early on, that because he was running it as more of a family shop, they weren't able to negotiate the same level of deal. So he's really tried to be very involved in all the domains of his career, very much on a personal level. And a lot of athletes outsource that and delegate that, but he's really tried to keep his hand in it. And he's a very curious person by nature. You spend time with him, he's somebody who's always asking you questions, asking questions of people that he meets day to day. It's not just a one-way exchange with him. It's very much a two-way exchange.
Mm. And looking back at his legacy, if indeed this is the end for him, which you say it might be, how do you think he's changed the sport?
You know, it's a great question. I've asked that question of a lot of people in their reporting for this book, because you look at his game, and there's a lot of things that he does that you really just can't teach, no matter how much you'd like to. The elegance of his movement and his footwork, sort of his ability to have a vision of the court where he seems to have a bit more time than so many other athletes to react and respond. It almost is like he has an extra half second in which he can kind of organize himself and make his decisions. And all that I don't think is teachable. But his style of play with the one-handed backhand, which is a style of play that many thought would go extinct, has clearly had an impact. If you look at players like Stefanos Tsitsipas, the young Greek player, and Denis Shapovalov, and Lorenzo Musetti, this young Italian player, all have glorious one-handed backhands. And a lot of that has to do with Roger and the fact that he's shown the way on that. And I think personally, as a gift to tennis, that's a pretty important one, because it's a wonderfully crowd-pleasing shot and it's got so much variety. And I think he's also changed the game and the sport by making it clear, again, back in the days of the Australian greats like Ken Rosewall. Ken Rosewall played into his early 40s, but it's been a long time since anybody did that in a meaningful way. And Roger has shown, even in this era, which is so competitive and so physical and grueling, that with the proper approach and the right mentality, you can play and excel for a long period of time and really extend your career as a tennis player. And I guarantee you that all the young stars of today and the stars on the rise have taken note of that. And the other thing, the last thing I think is important, is really his manner. Because a lot of superstar athletes, let's face it, are prima donnas. And, fail what I call the taxi driver test, which is if you're in a taxi with somebody who has no influence over you and no real ability to impact you, how do you treat that person? How do you treat somebody who really can't give you anything? And I have to say, sadly, that a lot of people I've come across in sport, they fail that test. Roger does not. Roger's somebody who treats people with respect and tends to, have a lot of empathy in that domain, in that regard. And I think younger players who've seen him do this for a long time and handle the press conferences in three languages, even though he's number one and probably would rather be somewhere else, and kind of play his ambassador's role, I think he set the bar in a new place that some of the previous champions did not. He also has been very involved in the governance of the game and trying to help with that as well. So you can see people take that responsibility on in the younger generation who probably would not have if Roger hadn't set that example. So I think those are all things that he'll leave behind.
And Christopher, just finally, before we go, I just want to return to your own life and work, because you really are one of the, if not the most preeminent tennis writer in the world. You won the Alan Trengrove Award for Excellence in Tennis Journalism. You've covered 14 Olympics, 5 World Cups, 5 America's Cups, 9 Ryder Cups, more than 80 Grand Slam tournaments. You also had the Eugene L. Scott Award, given in memory of the late publisher of Tennis Week magazine. And so with all of that under your belt and then writing sports biography, I wonder how, as a genre, you translate the physical drama of tennis onto the page.
I have to say, I've always thought that it was great to have a job that you could never quite perfect or master. And this is certainly one of them, because you can always find a way to make another phone call or choose a better metaphor or a better description. So I think that is at the time is daunting and frustrating, but it's also inspiring because you always can get better at this. And I'm still trying to get better in my mid-50s, haven't done this for 30 plus years, and all those road trips that you described there, it takes a while to say them. But in Roger's case, tennis can be challenging to write about because there's so many points, and the points are relatively short and matches can last a long time. So I think instead of giving readers blow by blow, you really have to synthesize and have to find a way to capture the moment and capture the matches through summing them up in terms of their style of play and the things that really come across from a visual standpoint as you're sitting there in the stands. And I've always tried to project that into my writing. And I've tried to do that with this book as well. I really was conscious that people did not want to read about 100 matches. They wanted to read about what made Roger tick and what made Nadal and Djokovic tick and where they came from and what their origin stories were. So that's what I really tried to focus on.
And you absolutely succeeded. Christopher Clary, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Georgina. Real pleasure for me. Thank you.
The Master, The Brilliant Career of Roger Federer by Christopher Clary is published by John Murray. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hole, Holly Fisher and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.